Ladies and gentlemen, it's 11:04 and time for the penguin on top of your radios to explode with joy because we have with us a penguin expert. Yes, let me set this up as a matter of fact. I was at a conference last weekend in New York City, and it's one of these conferences, I go to them twice a year because they're kind enough to ask me, and it's, pardon me, it's about all these people who are pitching their books and pitching their CDs and pitching their reason to get on TV and the radio. So they have a bunch of media people there, folks from like CBS Television and 48 Hours and Parents Magazine and whoever. And of course, writers and journalists and hosts of shows are looking for people to talk to. We figure it isn't just all celebrities pushing their movies or big rock stars who get on these shows. If you put on your morning television, a lot of these people are experts in some kind of field. They write cookbooks. They've had big life-changing stories that they want to tell. They're an expert on sports if it's around the time of the Super Bowl. So a lot of times the producers of these programs have to go out scouting and looking for people who are experts in these fields to be on the shows. So this conference that I go to is this confluence thing. They try to match the people doing the programs with people who want to get on these programs. Now, the problem for me in doing a show like Dave's Gone By is that so many of the people that I'm approached at conferences like this have really no reason to be on my show. It's like I don't do cooking segments. I don't do segments about rewriting your living will. I don't do stuff about, I was in a terrible car accident and therefore found Jesus and changed my life. I don't care. No offense, but I just don't care. I like musical things, as everybody knows, and I like things that come a little bit out of left field and are a little bit different. Well, you don't get too many of those at these conferences, unfortunately, but I'm very happy to say that, I was getting person after person pitching me these things, and I'm like, okay, it sounds kind of interesting. Oh, how to spice up your love life for Valentine's Day. Yippee-doo. Okay. And then suddenly, woman comes up to me and she says, I helped clean and save almost 20,000 penguins. I was like, what? She said, there was this oil spill in South Africa, and I heard about it, and I know how to deal with penguins. I've been working with them, and I had to go help. I had to help coordinate the effort to save all these poor penguins that were covered with oil. And pretty much I said, okay, you're on the show immediately, if not sooner. I was tempted to wait until National Penguin Day, or Internet, something. And what is it, World Penguin Day? Diane, and first of all, how you got involved with penguins in the way, way back when? What before even the oil spill, before even this, you were an expert in penguins. How did that all come about?
And when I was very young, the show Flipper, which people of a certain age will remember,
Flipper,
was about a dolphin that would rescue people from doing extraordinarily stupid things. And I was fascinated with dolphins, and I always wanted to become a dolphin trainer. And as I got older, that sort of went into the background. It was a fantasy. I thought, that happens in the movies or to other people. But eventually, when I was 32, I decided if I don't at least pursue this, I'm going to look back at the end of my life and regret not having tried to work with dolphins. So I returned to college to become a veterinary nurse. I had a Bachelor of Science degree in animal science. And in the course of my college, I had an internship at Boston's New England Aquarium working with the penguins. And it was a full-time four-month internship. And as soon as I stepped foot in the exhibit, I was hooked. These guys just had so much personality, and they were so much fun to be around. And so that's how I came to first work with penguins. And when I graduated from college, I was actually hired as a penguin aquarist. And so that's how it all started with penguins.
A penguin aquarist. I didn't know there was such a term. What is something that we wouldn't know or expect about working with penguins? You know, if you were to pick up and hold a penguin, what is something that people would not expect?
That it'll bite the crap out of you.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they nasty little creatures?
Well, they can be. I mean, they're very temperamental. Yeah. They each have their own personality, but they do have extremely sharp beaks, and they're very territorial and defensive of their space. So if you go into their space essentially uninvited, they may very well reach out and bite you with this beak that has a very sharp hook on the end, and it's razor sharp on the edges. And so I can tell you, you know, both from working with them at the New England Aquarium and from handling all the penguins we did in South Africa that were wild birds, that I'm covered with scars from penguin bites.
Now, here's the deal. You know, why didn't that turn you off? Why didn't it? So the first time a penguin bit or scratched you, didn't you go, you know, I think I'll work with ferrets or something? I mean, really?
Well, because they're just being penguins, you know. This is their natural behavior. They're just doing what they would do, and I found them endearing despite that. You know, there's so much more to them. They have such unique personalities. I think that's the thing that surprised me the most, because you see a penguin colony, and there's all these penguins hanging out together, and in the wild there could be millions of them. And you think, oh, a bunch of birds, and how different could they all be from each other? But when you work with them, you know, on an individual level, day by day, you really discover that each bird is just as individual as each person is. So they all have their own personality, and getting to know each individual was really fun and really rewarding.
Huh. So what are different penguin personalities like? No, seriously, I mean, we have dogs. And we have one dog that likes to nap and likes to cuddle on your lap and lick your face, and then we have another dog that just wants to chase the ball a million times a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I actually usually would compare them to cats. They really remind me of cats in that they recognize their names. So each bird at the New England Aquarium has its own name, and they all know their names. And so, like a cat, if I called a penguin and it felt like coming over to visit me, you know, because we would be in the water in wetsuits, and if it felt like coming over, it would swim right over and greet me.
Oh.
And if, on the other hand, I called a penguin and it didn't feel like it, it would look at me over its shoulder and just swim away in the opposite direction. So they could be aloof. They could be affectionate. And, for example, there was one penguin that we had there named Good Hope, and he was the largest bird in the exhibit, and he was a very territorial male. But he had a habit of dive-bombing people underwater. And so he especially did not like women. He was raised primarily by male aquarists, and for some reason he didn't like women, so he would dive-bomb you underwater.
What do you mean? How, it would just go under you? What do you mean?
Now, well, our exhibit at the New England Aquarium has water that's about 4 feet deep, 3.5 to 4 feet deep, and so we would get into wetsuits and walk through the exhibit to clean the islands and vacuum the pool and feed the penguins. And so what Good Hope would do would be to suddenly go underwater and come speeding at you underwater and just bite you on the buttocks or the
thigh. Ow! That's awful!
I know!
They're horrible little creatures! I mean, I know they look cute, but I don't want no bird biting me on the ass. Well, you know, it sounds funny, but I remember way, way back when in college, I had an assignment to do a photography thing, and I decided to photograph the birds, the geese, at our local park back on Long Island. And I remember the geese just came at me and surrounded me and started, like, pecking at my bag and crapping everywhere and just really almost attacking me like Hitchcock. And it was creepy. I mean it. I mean, it was my park, too. You know, I have every right to be there. But they're pecking, and you know, they're also their crotch high. So you kind of a little creeped out, you know? So, all right, so let's get to the story that you tell in your book, The Great Penguin Rescue, which is published by, let's see, this is, I can't see it.
Free Press, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster.
Oh, cool. And you also say that if people buy the book, a portion of the proceeds from the book are going to Penguin Rescue. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's going to Penguin Rescue, 20% of my proceeds. And also, just as I was finishing the final round of copy edits, the Gulf oil spill disaster occurred. And so now part of my proceeds are also going to go to Gulf oil spill relief and restoration efforts.
Actually, I have a question that has nothing to do with anything that anybody listening would care about, but My wife and I are going to New Orleans in about 3 weeks. Is it safe to eat the seafood?
I wouldn't.
Really? Not anything. That's
probably politically incorrect of me to say, if you're from there. But I don't think it's still, you know, the oil is still in the water underneath the surface because the dispersants just didn't really make it go away. They just made it sink and dissipate a bit. Mm-hmm. And so it's in the food chain. So personally, I wouldn't eat seafood there.
Until when?
Boy, that's a good question. I think this is going to be impacting that area for decades, and I don't know the answer exactly to when it's going to be completely safe and completely eliminated from the environment, but I don't think it's going to be for quite some time.
Okay. Well, let me ask, this is a really selfish kind of question, but it's a selfish, shellfish kind of question. But if they're taking shrimpies or clams or whatever, scallops, and they're boiling them before they cook, you know, to eat them, is that getting out the ugh, or is it still there?
I don't know. I mean, not being a chemist or a scientist, but as far as I know, that's not going to get rid of the toxins. You know, the dispersant that they use is not just the oil, it's also the dispersant, the Corexit that was used. Uh-huh. And in fact, I was supposed to go to the Gulf to help with the cleanup, the bird rescue efforts there, because the same people I was working with in South Africa were down in the Gulf overseeing the de-oiling of the pelicans and the birds. And I was going to go and stay for a month, and just before I was leaving, the information about the Corexit started hitting the papers. And this was the same dispersant that was used after the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska 20 years ago. Uh-huh. And 20 years later, most of the workers that were on the front lines of that cleanup effort, the ones that were spraying the Corexit, they're dead. And if they're not dead, they have chronic respiratory problems, and they have all sorts. I mean, it affects every system essentially in the body. And one of the things it also can do is cause kidney failure. And I was just born with one kidney. And I'd really like to keep it. Yeah. I'd like to keep it, so...
Wait, what the hell did your parents do with your other kidney?
I don't know. Offered it to the highest bidder? I don't know what happened.
Wow. You have to be careful with that. I mean, they wouldn't have... I guess when you're born with one kidney, they don't want to transplant another into you. You're okay with one, right? Is that the deal?
Right.
Wow.
Right. The one's functioning fine, but, you know, only having one and not having a backup... I felt as though, you know, it was really strongly recommended that I did not go to the Gulf. But there are people now living there that are having really horrendous health problems now. And it's primarily because of the Corexit that was sprayed down there.
Good.
So, personally, I would not swim in the water. I wouldn't go swimming in the ocean.
Okay.
You know, they've brought in a lot of sand to cover up the oil on the beaches. So it's not as though it's all gone. It's just covered. So I wouldn't, you know, be hanging out on the shore, I don't think, if I was going there.
Good Lord. Good Lord. Remember we'll go to Baton Rouge instead? Remember we'll go to Arizona instead. But let's talk specifically about what brought you from Boston Aquarium to that one big oil spill. I mean, there is a difference from learning stuff in an aquarium, becoming an aquarist, and physically going down during a crisis and coordinating the polishing up of 20,000 birds.
Mm.
So how did that really work out?
Well, it certainly is quite a paradigm shift to go from being in an exhibit with 70 penguins to walking into this massive warehouse filled with 19,000 oil-covered penguins.
Yeah.
I was not coordinating it. There were the two main groups coordinating this were IFAW, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, and IBRRC, which is the group that was down south, the International Bird Rescue and Research Center. They're based in California. And then SANCOB is a local penguin rescue center in South Africa. So they were sort of the three primary groups overseeing everything. I was brought in, I was part of the first team of penguin experts to fly in from the States. There were eight of us on that flight. And we arrived just 1 week after the oil spill occurred, and we were immediately put to work as rehabilitation supervisors. And so we each were given different tasks. So for example, two of the folks on my team, Gail Stropinski and Martin Vince, they were put in charge of making sure the food for the penguins, the sardines or pilchards that were being fed to them, uh-huh. were being properly thawed and prepared, and vitamins were being put in them,
oh,
et cetera.
Yeah.
On my job with my coworker Heather Urquhart from the New England Aquarium, we were put in charge of running room 2, and room 2 had 4,500 oiled penguins in it.
Good Lord.
Yeah, that's what we said. And so we essentially had to be training completely inexperienced volunteers that would come in. There were 1,000 volunteers that came to this rescue center to help on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And over the course of this rescue, 12,500 volunteers came. None of them had any experience. So our job was to train them how to safely handle the penguins, how to force feed them. So every penguin had to be force fed several fish a day. And there were other groups that were training volunteers how to actually de-oil the penguins.
Well, this is the day before Halloween. So if you want to give people a really kind of awful, creepy, scary feeling, tell people what happens to a penguin when it's covered with oil. Mm-hmm. If it isn't treated, if nobody helps it, what's the time frame and what physically happens to an oil-slicked penguin?
Well, what happens to an oil-slick penguin? First, at sea, when they get oiled, a few things can happen. They can actually become waterlogged and drown because the oil clumps up and separates their feathers, and so now the ocean water can get through and penetrate down to their skin, and they can become hypothermic. They get too cold. They also can get waterlogged because that water now gets into the downy base of their feathers, so they can drown. If they make it to shore, and what they'll do is head for shore because they're so cold, they head for shore, and if nobody comes along to rescue them, essentially they will stand on shore and starve to death because it's too cold for them to go into the water to hunt for food. Now, what also can happen is they'll immediately start preening, which is they're grooming themselves. They're trying to remove the oil from their body, but they use their beak to preen their feathers. And so when they do that, they inadvertently will ingest or swallow that oil.
Mm.
Now, what happens when they swallow the oil is really the awful part, is that it has a number of different effects. They'll become dehydrated, but also it will start to break down their red blood cells. They'll burst the red blood cells, and they'll become anemic. They also, it just becomes completely toxic in their bodies. And so they get bleeding ulcers, the mucous membranes and their inside their mouth, in their stomach, will become ulcerated. And so eventually they'll die from toxic effects.
Essentially, they turn into old Jewish men. That's what happens. But seriously, it's horrible. It's awful. I assume it was more like a Goldfinger thing, where if you paint everybody in gold, it seeps in and it's toxic because it's covering all their any membranes that they can get air through. But you're saying it's more internal, it's more ingesting, and the whole thing about them becoming cold in the water, and it's really awful stuff. So then now the flip side of that question. You got a penguin that's covered in oil. How do you clean it?
Essentially, with dishwashing soap, hot water, a toothbrush, and high-pressure hoses. So you take a penguin, and it takes two people to clean one penguin. And in South Africa, during this penguin rescue, it would take about 45 minutes on average to clean a penguin. But when they were heavily oiled, they would have to go through 10 or 13 washes. It was quite a stressful ordeal for the penguin, as well as for the handlers. These are the penguins that are thrashing and kicking and biting, but you would take a vat of hot water and you put in dishwashing soap. And prior to that, they're actually sprayed down with a first stage degreaser. And you essentially used a lighter oil to start breaking down this heavy crude oil. And so they would soak in the degreaser for about 15 or 20 minutes. Then they would get put into this first vat of hot soapy water and scrub through, agitate through all the feathers, and then use a toothbrush around the delicate areas around the face to scrub the oil out of the feathers.
Yeah.
And they essentially would go from tub to tub until the water ran clear. And then once the water runs clear, indicating there's no more oil on the feathers, they would go be rinsed with a high-pressure hose. Now, in a normal situation where you just have a few penguins, you would rinse the penguins for about a half hour. Because if you don't remove all of the soap, that will interfere with them being able to waterproof their feathers again. And so, but because we had 20,000 penguins to wash, we couldn't spend 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. So they go through a brief 5-minute rinse, and then they go under heat lamps to dry out overnight, and then they will be swum for 1 to 2 weeks in these large pools of salt water. And that would essentially, they continue rinsing out the rest of that soap residue on their own. And then once they're waterproof, then they can be released again.
Now, assuming a penguin goes through this entire process, how close are they to normal to the point where had they ever been in an oil spill? In other words, has it still cut years off their, I don't know how long a penguin lives actually, but I mean, what percentage of normal are they if they've been cleaned?
It's a great question. It's a really important point. These penguins have been very closely monitored in the 10 years since this oil spill, and we know from tracking them that their survival rate matched that of their unoiled counterparts.
Really?
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, there was this German biologist, Sylvia Gauss, during the recent BP spill, who was saying, oh, just euthanize all the oiled birds because only 1% survive after rehabilitation anyway. Well, she was completely wrong about that. We actually saved 90% of these oiled penguins, and they went on to live just as long as the birds who had never been oiled. And their breeding was only impacted for the first year or two, and that's probably because they were separated from their mates when they were collected to be brought to this rehab center. But after that, they've gone on, and they've become just as reproductively viable as their unoiled counterparts.
Well, that is
really important that we do these, you know, rescue these birds. Yeah.
Hey, here's something I'm curious about. When you were doing, obviously you're taking proceeds from the book to help with these kinds of these spills and these disasters. Did any money when this boat? What was the boat that?
It was ironically called the Treasure.
The Treasure, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much money did they put towards cleanup? And did that money include penguin money, or was it just for the water?
They actually were. Held responsible for paying for everything. So they had to pay for all of the rehabilitation efforts for the bird as well as all of the cleanup of oil in the environment. And that was a bill of about $6.5 million.
Which was a drop in the bucket to them, I'll bet. I'll bet it was nothing. I'll bet it was a drop in the bucket to them, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right.
How do you feel, this person aside, how do you feel BP handled the disaster that it created?
Personally, I think their actions are criminal. The fact that this dispersant they're using, it's banned for use in the UK. So here's this British Petroleum Company that is spraying a dispersant here that they can't even use in their own country because it's been banned because it's so toxic. And because of what's happening now down there with both the seafood and the people in this area, the impact's going to be felt for decades and decades. And it's destroyed lives, it's destroying fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think, what they did really down there is criminal.
Well, beyond the dispersant, have they been doing well, so to speak, in other aspects of the cleanup? Or are they just awful all the way around with everything?
Well, I'm not going to be speaking favorably about BP. I think they were doing a lot to cover up what was going on down there. They weren't allowing the press to come in and interview and show photographs of what was happening. They were hiding things. They were not being transparent about what was going on. So,
Of course they were trying to. We would get these commercials where they would find a black person and go, I live, in New Orleans and I work for British Petroleum and we're trying, we're cleaning it up, we're doing the best we can. Yeah. Did you see those commercials? They were incredibly insulting. It was amazing, It was like, let's find a black person who works for us and throw them up there, and say they live in New Orleans, and you know, oops, we're sorry, but we're making good.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't buy any of it.
So let me ask you, what do you do? You just wrote a book. Congratulations, the Great Penguin Rescue, published by Free Press and available in all normal places that books are sold.
Yeah, it just came out this week.
Great! Oh, perfect timing! Yay! But people didn't get it. No, because sometimes I have people on my show that wrote a book. It's like 8 months old. I'm like, oh, so it just came out this week. Great release. But people can get it at Amazon, and people can get it at blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you can get it, you know, at Amazon, online, at the big bookstores, the Barnes & Noble and Borders, and also certainly, you know, shop at your local independent bookstores, because many of them are carrying the book as well.
And what about your website? Can they get it directly from you?
Yeah, they can. My website is thepenguinlady.com, and I do have links to several of the online places where they can purchase the book through.
Oh, great. Is it better for you? Where's the best place for you if people want to buy the book? If they get it from you, do you get more money? Or if they get it from the independent bookstore? How does that work?
It doesn't matter. Wherever they buy, if they buy it in a bookstore, whether it's a big bookstore or an independent or online, you know, it doesn't matter. Either place is fine.
So let me ask you also, Diane and Napoli, before I let you go, now that you've... This is an event that happened 10 years ago. You've just written the book. What do you do? Are you still allied with an aquarium? What's your job now? What do you do?
Oh, well, I am the Penguin Lady. So that's my business. The name of my business is the Penguin Lady. Mm-hmm. I left the New England Aquarium, it was 6 years ago today. I think it was my last day at the New England Aquarium. And I started up my educational company. So my mission is to raise awareness and funding to help protect penguins. And so I do educational programs for both children and adults. And, you know, I'll go to schools and museums and libraries. I've spoken internationally. I've been hired on cruise ships. I was in Antarctica and the Galapagos Islands last year. And I donate 20% of my proceeds from every appearance as well to penguin rescue groups. And so I hope, you know, that other people will be inspired to do the same. And so in the appendix of my book, there's actually a list of organizations that people can donate to if they want to do something to help penguins themselves.
And if, God forbid, there's another spill, you know, as you said, when you were working down at this spill in South Africa, 1,000 people came to volunteer. If they're trained properly, can anybody clean a penguin if they have to? If we have another one of these things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want to do it on your own. You would certainly want to, you know, contact the authorities who are in charge of whatever rescue effort there is, because it's not legal to just go and grab wildlife, unless you are a trained wildlife rehabilitator.
Fair enough.
You could get in trouble. So, just, you know, everybody has wonderful, intentions, but not only could you be injured, the animal could be injured as well. So you would want to make sure you get that animal to the proper authorities or let them know where that animal is.
Oh, actually, this did occur to me. I mean, it's kind of it's a pretty dumb question, but, I mean, I guess you need dexterity when you're trying to clean off a penguin. But could you wear gloves so that if they bit you? You say you got bites and scars. What about wearing gloves? Or, no.
No, it's an excellent question, and they did give us gloves. They gave us these very thick rubber gloves to wear to protect our hands.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, several of us stopped using the gloves because it made it much harder to handle the birds, to manage handling them. So, you know, a lot of us just said, the heck with the gloves, and we didn't wear them. But most of the volunteers, because they didn't have the same experience, you know, how to capture a penguin without getting bitten, usually did wear the gloves. But those of us that had experience with penguins tended not to wear them.
Cool. And the one thing I also kind of wanted to ask you about, since we didn't really get into the book so much, is that some of your colleagues were characters, in a manner of speaking. So you could just tell us, because I want to give people another reason besides helping penguins, or if they're interested in the birds, that there's some human interest in the book. It isn't just, you know, oh, here are the penguins, we clean them, and, you know, these companies are bad when they're crashing into things and leaking oil. Well, what are some of the human interest kind of kooky characters that you work with?
Well, I think this, you know, there's sort of two parts to my book, or to this whole story. And one of it is the animal rescue effort, you know, the physical capturing the penguins, cleaning them, restoring them to health. But the other piece really was this human story, which was so incredible. I mean, there, I think the one of the things that stays with me the most were all of these people that came just because they cared about these animals. So 12,000 people who had no experience came because they wanted to save the penguins. And it was something that those of us in these positions of helping to run things, every time we started to think about it or talk about it, we would just start crying because it was so moving. And it really, everybody kept saying, it's restored my faith in mankind. You know, here people have caused this awful disaster for the penguins, but all these people are here because they care about the animals and want to save them. So to me, that was a huge part of this rescue effort, was what happened, the human response to it.
Yeah, no, but when I was talking more specifically, like in the book chapter, it mentions co-workers like Big Mike you know, tell us about somebody. There was a guy named Welcome. That was his name.
Welcome. He was such a sweetheart. Welcome, he was Khoza from the Khoza tribe in South Africa. And if people aren't familiar with Khoza, they might have heard of them because they have this click language that I can't do it. Yeah.
Neither can I.
What I'm talking about.
Yeah. Like Miriam McKenna. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That language. Yeah. Khoza. And so Welcome, part of my time was spent at this huge warehouse that had been set up, and part of it was at SANCOP, the local rehabilitation center, which they had become overrun with penguins, which is why they had to build this satellite rescue. And so my time was divided between the two rescue centers. And Welcome was a volunteer at SANCOP, and he just had the most gentle spirit. And as I mentioned before, we were dealing with these wild, thrashing, biting penguins. However, Welcome had this magical ability to pick up a penguin and restrain it while one of us was drawing blood. Ooh. But as soon as he picked up the penguin, the bird would completely relax in his arms. And they just wouldn't move a muscle. And even when I'm poking them, you know, in the toe, getting blood, the bird isn't moving. It's not responding. And he just had the most incredible ability with these animals. It was almost like this psychic connection or something.
Yeah.
And so, you know, after the first time that I was working with Welcome, I said, please, you have to promise me you'll be my handler.
Yeah.
Every bird I have to draw blood from. It was really a beautiful, beautiful thing to watch.
If I were still dating, I want, you know, this guy's my wingman, literally. Wingman picking up chicks, literally.
Yeah.
Too many puns to the man. What about one other character? One other...
You mentioned Big Mike.
Big Mike.
And I think, Big Mike is truly larger than life. He runs a martial arts school in South Africa, and he came as a volunteer at the very beginning of this rescue effort. He had a friend who was a volunteer at SANCOP and said, we need help, you know, collecting the birds and then building this rescue center. And so he was there from the start, and he's 6'7", weighs, I think, 270 pounds. And has this huge booming bass voice. And when he arrived at this satellite rescue center that was built in 3 days' time and was filled with 16,000 penguins within a week and a half time, he saw that, you know, there's 1,000 volunteers a day and they really need some coordination and management. And so he just stepped naturally into this role. And because he was so massive and had such a huge voice, nobody was going to argue with the guy.
He'll just pick up a penguin and hit you with it. You're like, shut up! You do what I say.
Yeah.
Oh, see, this is the reason that everybody should go out there and get a copy of The Great Penguin Rescue from Free Press, a Simon & Schuster imprint. It's by Diane DiNapoli. And let's make sure... Actually, they don't even need to know how to spell your name. It's rather unusually spelled. All they have to do is go to your website, thepenguinlady.com. ThePenguinLady.com. So Diane, I want to thank you and welcome you, literally, again, to the neighborhood, and thank you so much for sharing these stories and this amazing work that you do. If there's one thing that you'd like people to sort of take away from this interview that they should know about penguins or about our environment or trying to stave off disasters, What would it be?
Well, it would be that, you know, it's important that we all take a look at our habits and see how we're impacting the environment, because 14 of the 18 penguin species are threatened or endangered. And the primary problems are global warming and overfishing. And so if we can all look at our carbon footprints and understand what it is and how to reduce it, reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, because that's going to help this whole global warming problem, as well as the oil spill issue. And so I think it's just important that we all are aware of our impact on the environment and do what we can to reduce it, because if we help save the penguins, we're going to save the oceans. And ultimately, by doing that, we're going to save ourselves.
Diane DiNapoli, thank you for saving us from ourselves. Thank you so much for that. And thank you especially for bringing your love and knowledge of the penguin world to the neighborhood. Good
luck. Well, thank you, Dave. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks.